Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, Jason Croft, master of the controls. Glad you're listening today. The confusion from the contested vote count in the 2000 presidential election reminded us that our electoral system is far from perfect. Most of the major news coverage has focused on problems with the mechanics of voting: butterfly ballots, hanging chads, polling irregularities, and absentee voter returns. But it has occurred to a number of people that maybe we have deeper problems with our electoral system. The media highlighted that more individual voters cast ballots for Al Gore, but George W. Bush won the Electoral College. But for a long time, in a great many electoral contests, the winning candidate has received a minority of votes. In elections with more than two candidates, it's possible, perhaps even likely, that the winner will be chosen by a minority of voters. In our winner-take-all system of elections, the majority does not always rule. In fact, it may be disenfranchised. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with Stephen Hill, a writer and political activist and co-founder of the Center for Voting and Democracy. He has written articles and commentary for dozens of publications, including The Nation, The Wall Street Journal, The Los Angeles Times, Salon, and The Washington Post. He was the campaign manager for Proposition A in San Francisco, which resulted in the adoption of instant runoff voting to elect that city's government. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that during this hour. Stephen Hill is also the co-author of the book Whose Vote Counts with Robert Ritchie, and he is the author of a new book we'll be drawing from during this hour. It is entitled Fixing Elections: The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, recently published by the Rutledge Press. As we talk with Stephen Hill, you are invited into the conversation. That's what this show is all about, public dialogue on important issues. The number around Champaign-Urbana for you to call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, the other states our signal reaches, and via the Internet anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We also have an email address if you'd like to send us a question by email on the topic. That would be welcome. You can send that to talk@uiuc.edu anytime during this hour. And Stephen Hill joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Let me ask you, there's a whole bunch of things that I'm sure we're going to talk about, but let's start by asking the question, can you tell us about the Center for Voting and Democracy?
Sure. The Center is a nonprofit educational organization. We're 10 years old, and we are primarily a research and education organization, and we look at voting systems, which is something that people have not had a lot of experience in looking at. You know, a lot of times when we think about how to reform the system, we talk about campaign finance reform or ballot access laws, and now, of course, punch cards and voting equipment and all important things. But the voting system is actually the engine of any democracy. It's what drives all the rest. And, you know, we have a nice little educational presentation, a slideshow, where we can show you take the same exact votes and put them through different voting systems, and you can come up with completely different results in terms of who gets elected. And so for a lot of people, that's an eye-opener, that it could seem so arbitrary as that. You know, whatever voting system you have dramatically affects representation, participation. It affects the type of policy that gets passed. It affects the way campaigns are conducted, and it affects to some degree our sense of national cohesion or national unity. And so, all these things, those are the five areas that I go into in my book, Fixing Elections, and looking at how the winner-take-all system at this point in our history, in here at the outset of the 21st century, is negatively impacting our nation. In numerous ways, in those five areas: representation, participation, campaigns and discourse of ideas, policy, and national unity.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this phrase, winner-take-all politics, and what that means.
Well, the winner-take-all politics is a function of the winner-take-all voting system. And the winner-take-all voting system is simply, you know, we elect all these single districts all around the country, both for the U.S. Congress and then for the for our state legislatures, and then also for our governors and presidents, and also for many times for city council. And in a single seat district, as it's called, the highest vote getter wins, and everyone who voted for that person gains a representative, and everyone who votes for any of the other candidates essentially loses and has no representation. And we've had to wallpaper over this winner-take-all aspect of our system by coming up with this truly odd notion that the person represents you just because they sit in the chair. Even if you didn't vote for that representative, and even if they are somehow diametrically opposed to your point of view. And you can hear this all the time, like, well, that person's still my representative. And, you know, and so I've been asking people, well, how is that person your representative? You didn't vote for them. They don't represent anything that you believe. Why is it that we would call that person our representative? I mean, it raises some odd notions, like, you know, perhaps Newt Gingrich represented all the Democrats in his district, or perhaps Jesse Jackson Jr. represents all of the conservative Republicans in his district, and, you know, perhaps the British crown really did represent the colonists, so why did they toss the tea into the harbor to begin with, you know? And so I think we really have to start looking at some of these basic notions that we have in our country, which are the result of using a winner-take-all system.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the lessons of what you call Unelection 2000. What did that tell us about the problems with our electoral system? And I think that you start with this map that shows the voting patterns and maybe draw some lessons from that.
Right. Well, what we saw in the Unelection 2000, and particularly, say, in the presidential election, we saw that the president, the person who won, did not have a majority of the popular vote. But we also saw some other uncomfortable facts. For instance, if Al Gore had won, he would have been able to fly from Washington, D.C. to California without passing over a single state that he won. What we saw was an alarming balkanization that's happening in our country, a regional breakdown that we've seen in other winner-take-all nations in the past, like India, for instance, and even Canada, where one part of the country goes for one party and another part of the country goes for the other political party. In the United States, we saw that the western states outside of the coastal states have become solidly Republican. In the past, that wasn't always true. The places like Montana would elect Democrats like Mike Mansfield, kind of populist Democrats, and Idaho would elect a Frank Church. But we're not seeing that anymore. The mountain states and down through Southwest are becoming pretty solidly conservative. The South, of course, when it comes to presidential elections, is pretty solidly conservative and Republican. And then you have the Democrats who are winning mostly the urban areas. And so even in places like California, which is a Democratic state, most of the Democratic votes come from just the coastal area, and the inner parts of California are becoming solidly conservative. And so you're having these situations where you can see state legislatures, like in Idaho and other places, where the Republicans will win, say, 60% of the vote, but they'll win 70, 80, 90% of the seats. You're getting these huge distortions between the popular vote and the number of seats won because of the distortions of the single-seat districts and how those are created during the redistricting process. And so you're getting these huge distortions where one side is winning way more power than they should, and the other side is winning way less power. It affects what legislative policy is produced, how ideas are debated or discussed in all these different states. And so this kind of regional breakdown is quite new in our history. Usually you saw more of a mix of Democrats and Republicans being elected all over the country. But now, as I said, we're getting these kind of regional balkanizations.
Stephen, you put your finger on something that I'd like you to talk a little bit more about, and that's the redistricting process that maybe fuels this balkanization that you're talking about.
Yes, it certainly is. In the redistricting process, what happens is basically the incumbents and party leaders and their technocrats sit beyond, at a computer, and they draw the district lines. They draw themselves safe seats. And not only do they draw themselves safe seats, but say you're the party in your state that controls redistricting, you can manipulate the districts and how many of your types of voters you pack into each district in such a way as to win more than your fair share of seats. So you can, you know, there have been notorious examples where one party in a particular state will have, you know, maybe 55% of the popular vote statewide for their congressional seats, and they'll win 65, 70, 80% of the congressional seats. Mm-hmm. And it's because they've used techniques like some are called packing and cracking. If you control the redistricting process, what you do is you take as many of your opponent's voters and you pack them into as few districts as possible. You sacrifice a couple of districts, let them win those districts.
Well, that's not a good sound. I think we're going to have to recontact our guests since we're having a little problem with the phone line. And while Jason Croft takes care of that, let me reintroduce, during this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Stephen Hill. He is the founder and co-director of the Center for Voting and Democracy and author of the book we are drawing from during this hour. It is entitled Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, recently published by the Rutledge Press. In the book, he looks at what he describes as the breakdown of America's electoral system and some of the problems with the ways that we are conducting elections, and suggests a number of ways to remedy the situation, among them instant runoff voting, which hopefully we'll get to talk about with Stephen Hill as we reconnect and hopefully have a better phone line here. Stephen, are you there?
Yeah, very sorry about that. I don't know what if that was your end or my end.
Maybe somewhere in the middle. Well, that's all right. Weird things happen with phone lines sometimes. So
they do.
Anyway, here we are again.
So anyway, I was saying that if you use techniques like packing and cracking, you pack your opponents into a few districts, and as a result, you've made all the other districts around those districts more to your liking, more favorable to your party. And then they use other techniques like cracking, where if you have a concentration of the opponent's voters, you put the district line right down the middle and cut their numbers in half in each district, and you separate them into two separate districts or three separate districts. And so by using these techniques, and today the computers are extremely sophisticated, they have very good databases, and the process has really become extremely, extremely precise. That's, you know, where you see all these fingers sticking out of districts and long necks and these sorts of things, and you get districts that have been compared to the shape of splattered spaghetti sauce and squashed mosquitoes and all these sorts of things. And it's because, you know, the party leaders and the incumbents are using, they're manipulating the political process, the redistricting process, in order to draw the districts that, one, will guarantee them a safe seat, in other words, their own reelection, and two, will guarantee the preeminence of their political party. That's what the goal is. The goal is not in any way, shape, or form to somehow maximize the power of your vote as a voter. They're not concerned with that at all, and so they don't look to say, you know, how can we make as many competitive districts as possible so that each voter has a sense that their vote counts? Because what happens at the end of this process is that most voters basically have been drawn into safe seats where it doesn't matter if you show up to the polls or not, because everyone knows ahead of time who's going to win most districts. We at the Center for Voting and Democracy, one of the things we do is we make predictions over a year ahead of time about who's going to win each district without knowing anything about inequities in campaign finance or even oftentimes who the candidates are, just by looking at the demographics of the districts and how they were drawn in the last redistricting process. And so, you know, really what's happening in the redistricting process is voters are being sliced and diced right out of the political process.
And essentially the redistricting is controlled by the party in power. So the concentration of snowballs, in other words.
Right, and this last time we just had a redistricting in 2001, and it was more crass than even usual because they have even more powerful computers. In California, for instance, one of the congressional incumbents blurted out something that everyone always sort of suspected went on behind the scenes, but no one ever really admitted. She said each of the incumbents in California paid the political consultant who was drawing the district lines $20,000 apiece to draw them a safe seat. $20,000. I mean, this is protection money. There's no other word for it. And when she was questioned about that, she said, I mean, the reporter was somewhat incredulous, realizing the ramifications of this sort of practice. And she said, oh, hey, that's a bargain. I usually spend $3 million on reelection, and now all I had to do was spend $20,000, and I don't have to worry about reelection anymore. I'll be automatically reelected. So, you know, this is what's gone on just over the past year and a half. And the results, usually after redistricting, you expect that in the U.S. House, for instance, there'll be about 100 competitive seats, because after redistricting is when things are most competitive. You get people who don't run for reelection, you get some open seats and what have you. But this time around, most people are speculating maybe 30, 35, perhaps 40 U.S. House seats are competitive out of 435. In other words, all those are the only seats in which we don't know who's going to win. All the other ones are done deal, safe seats. Voters don't even need to bother showing up to the polls.
Now, this is the calculus on the part of the people who are running for office and those who support them, the consultants and the parties and so forth. And obviously that gives them a way to allocate their resources and perhaps focus their attention, including their campaign ads and their appearances in public places and so forth, and you know, affects the dialogue of the campaign by concentrating into those particular areas, would you say?
Certainly, because what it means is that, for instance, the control of the U.S. House, which is only six seats separating between Democrats and Republicans, the control, if six seats swing one way to the Democrats, they'll regain the control of the House. And there's only, you know, 35 seats, say, up for grabs. That means that's where all the campaigns are going to focus, and all the millions of dollars that are raised, they're not going to go to the safe seats where everything is a done deal. They're going to go to the handful of seats that are up for grabs. And not only that, they don't have to win every voter in those contested races, because they know a certain number of voters, most voters, are going to vote either for a Democrat or a Republican. There's going to be just a handful of voters, what we call the swing voters, 15% of voters who are undecided in those elections, that are going to be up for grabs. So even within those, you know, handful, three dozen or so congressional races, they're going to be targeting a small group of swing voters who are going to decide the winners in each one of those elections. A similar dynamic goes on in our presidential election. You know, I mean, we saw how close of a national election was, but in fact, everybody knew that all of the states, except for about eight states, were already safe states for one presidential candidate or another. They were done deals. It was only a handful of states in the 2000 presidential election that was up for grabs. Now, but they also knew that within those handful of states, there were, you know, most voters knew whether they were going to vote for a Democrat or a Republican. It was just a handful of swing voters, 10, maybe 15% of voters, who were up for grabs in those handful of swing states. And so what should be a national election really boils down to the most provincial of concerns, where the parties and the candidates have their polls and their focus groups that tell them, okay, here's the handful of states we have to win, here's the handful of voters within each of those states that we have to win, and so all of the appeals go to those handful of swing voters. Now, in November 2000, both parties had determined that the swing voters in those states were seniors who were predominantly white, higher than average income, and so that's why you saw the campaign ideas that were being talked about were things like Medicare, Social Security lockboxes, prescription drugs. Those dominated our presidential election debates as if there aren't other issues out there. And that's why, you know, as one 20-something said, I feel like if you're not 65 and older and have arthritis, these candidates have nothing to say to you. And it's exactly right, because the way they run campaigns today with their polls and their focus groups, they are targeting in a way that just slices and dices everyone else out of the political process. So all the issues that they care about, that other voters care about, besides prescription drugs, Social Security, Medicare, are basically left on the political sidelines, and all the voters that care about those issues are also left on the political sidelines.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. I'll mention the phone numbers again if other people would like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And by email, talk@will.uiuc.edu. We have a caller from Champaign County on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I had a specific question, then a more general, like, sort of, what do you suggest? In lieu of the second one, it's interesting to note that this isn't just a, you know, looking at European systems. Illinois actually had bullet voting, where we had the option of voting three votes in favor of one candidate. So it's a sort of cumulative voting thing. And a reformer who is well-meaning and who's done some good work, Citizens Utility Board, decided that was something he could campaign on and got rid of it. And I think it's been bad, actually, overall. The idea was we could lower the number of legislators. But this more specific question is, I guess it's more specific, is what about Florida? I'd like for you to hear review the situation and what do you think about the NAACP's settlement. And my understanding is that they didn't get a firm commitment to, you know, give immediate redress to the people who were called felons feloniously, as it were. That only like 5 or 6% of the people that were on that felons list were actually felons, and it's a huge scandal that hasn't been commented on enough. So I'm calling for you to do it again here, and I guess you might want to say something about the current fiasco down there too. Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call.
I think that the situation in Florida, I mean, my perspective on it is that, sure, all the issues of felons not being able to vote and the way they purge the rolls, and then also, you know, we've heard stories of police barricades set up that prevented some people from voting, and there were a million things that went wrong in Florida, and it sounds like from the recent primary they just had, they're still working out some of the bugs on their new voting equipment, so they're still having problems there. The thing that draws me to look at Florida is the fact that you had millions of voters going out there to vote, and it was pretty clear who Floridans preferred in terms of the major presidential candidates. They preferred Al Gore, and yet the voting system completely broke down. They used a plurality voting system where the highest vote getter wins regardless of whether they have a majority or not. And as a result of that process, they had someone win without a majority of the popular vote in Florida and also nationally. And so if they had used something like, say, instant runoff voting in Florida, where voters would be allowed to rank their candidates. So if you have your first choice, you know, so like Ralph Nader, voters could have put Nader as their first choice. And then you also have your runoff choice. You get to rank a second choice and a third choice if you want. And so Ralph Nader voters would have had an opportunity to rank Al Gore as their second choice, or even one of the other minor candidates as their second choice, and Al Gore as their third choice. If they had used some sort of runoff system like this in Florida, Al Gore would have won, despite all the discrepancies of felons and police barricades and all these sorts of things. Despite all of that went on, Al Gore still would have won Florida and hence would have won the presidency. That to me is in some ways the bigger problem here, because, you know, it's a lot more insidious of a way to thwart the popular will by using something like a voting system or even the voting equipment than setting up things like police barricades, you know, because the police barricade stuff is so crass, and the denying felons the right to vote is so crass that people see it right away. And it's much more surreptitious and sneaky, in a sense, to use these other ways that people don't focus on. And so I think that for me, the lesson of Florida 2000 is that, at the very least, the winners of each state should have to have a majority of the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think even beyond that, we should abolish the Electoral College. It's a holdover from the 18th century when it was put into place because the founders and framers did not trust the popular will. And it began to backfire right from the very beginning because the way it was constructed was an odd way to start with. But they didn't have a lot of examples to draw from in the 18th century.
Yeah.
We know a lot more about voting systems now and better ways to do it. And it's time to upgrade our voting system and the way we elect our president. But, you know, without more of an outcry, and now with what's going on in the Middle East, pretty much pushing everything off of the front pages, I think that also is too convenient for words, the way that all has been pushed off the front page by other events, as well as other things like Enron and all the things that have been going on in this country for the last couple of years have been pushed off the front page by the events in the Middle East. And so, unfortunately, I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of change. And they're even having trouble right now passing that federal bill that would allocate $3 billion for new voting equipment all across the country. So I think the citizens are going to have to get more outraged about what happened in Florida in November 2000 and start making more noise about it instead of what's going on in the Middle East.
Well, there's many things I want to ask you to follow up on. There was people, speaking of things being pushed off the front page, some people may be aware that there has been an election in Florida or a primary in which the The vote is very close between Janet Reno and the other the Democratic candidate. And again, voting problems are sort of putting a big question mark on who actually is the winner. And I haven't seen the news this morning about that, but you know, I wonder if you want to comment on that.
Well, from what I understand, and the news reports I've read have been fairly sketchy about what exactly the problem is in Florida this time around, but it sounds like, you know, they do have new voting equipment there, and it sounds like they didn't adequately train their poll workers about how to use it, and perhaps didn't adequately educate voters about how to fill out the new ballots. And, you know, and so here again is a good example. For instance, you know, the country of Brazil, okay, they have completely computerized their voting process. The voter goes in and votes on what is essentially a computer, and they push a button for their candidate, and a picture comes up on the computer screen so they can verify who they voted for and make sure it's the right person, okay? And many other countries around the world already have this problem completely solved for the most part. They don't have the problems that we have in this country. Now, here we are, as everyone has said, you know, the litany, the lone remaining superpower, the most powerful country the world has ever known, and yet we can't count the votes. We can't come up with the voting equipment and the proper training for our poll workers. Other nations pay their poll workers. We rely pretty much on a volunteer force all across the country. There's over 3,000 counties in this country, and they do things in a different way. And so what I'm saying is that we don't pay enough attention, and we don't put enough money, and we don't invest enough of our resources into our electoral infrastructure, from voting systems to voting equipment to poll workers. I mean, I can tell you numerous examples all across the country of just complete flub-ups that happen that are inexcusable for a country with our resources, but it's because somehow our politicians and our elected leaders don't value it enough to put the money and the resources into it, and you know, people in this country just aren't paying enough attention to what's going on, and you know, it just happens in state after state and county after county, and until we start realizing that we need to put more attention into what I call democracy technology, the way our democracy functions and the infrastructure that helps us decide our representative government, we're going to continue to have problems like this.
I'm looking at the news now from Florida, and it looks like the electoral difference between Bill McBride and Janet Reno is less than 8,000 votes, and a number of irregularities in terms of, you know, polling places not being open, and a variety of other problems with the system in place. Sort of put in question how accurate that vote count was, and I guess that we'll hear more news about that, I'm sure, in the coming days.
Right, and absolutely, and you know, I can tell you from experience that a lot of elected officials all across the country, you wonder how they got their jobs. It certainly wasn't because of their competency at running elections. And you know, I mean, look at Kathleen Harris in Florida. I mean, she was clearly a political hack, and she was overseeing elections in Florida. But this goes on in county after county across the country, where the people who got their jobs, it was not because they took some sort of civil service test or could show that they know the latest, have the latest information about voting system technology and know how it works. That's not why they got their jobs at all. It was politics that gave them their jobs. And we, in this country, we really need to look at this process from top to bottom and look at it in a way, in a systematic way, and look at what other nations do. And, you know, most nations, for instance, have an electoral commission that oversees their elections, not just one individual in a county that does whatever the heck they or she or he wants. They have an electoral commission that oversees it. They have national electoral commissions that oversee their electoral process for their country. We don't have anything of that nature. We have the FEC, perhaps, which is, you know, it's barely a regulatory body. So it's really time to look at these, as I said, to look at our entire electoral process from top to bottom, from voting systems to voting equipment, and get serious about democracy if that's really what we believe and what we export to the world.
Our lines are almost all full. I want to make sure we talk about instant runoff voting and proportional representation and some of the other issues you raise in your book. But I also want to defer to callers since that's what the show is all about as well. So let's talk next with another listener on line number one in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I usually work as an election judge on Election Day here in Champaign County, and we do get paid, not a whole lot, but the day is very long. And it's hard to get people to be election judges because you have to have the free time to be able to do that. And so election judges tend to be older, and sometimes they're getting older and frailer. So if anybody's out there who would like to try to help make our system work, they're going to have election judge training, and it's required in order to get the maximum amount of pay. And they're going to have it on the 17th and the 23rd. The 17th is at the Champaign County Farm Bureau, and the 23rd is at the Urbana Civic Center, and there'll be other places around the county. There's three different times each time. So somebody could call their local county clerk and ask when the training is for election judges. One of the things that I've tried to tell people that, you know, it's a long day, and you get tired of saying the same thing over and over again, is to check your ballot when you come out of the voting booth. And even so, at the end of the day, when we make sure we have the right number of ballots for the right number of people who came in and the right each type of ballot, we always find some that aren't marked or some that aren't punched fully. And we always have people who come out and say, I can't make this work. That's because they've tried to use the pencil for write-in votes instead of the stylus. People need to check their ballots when they come out, and they, you know, people are distracted. People make mistakes, but it isn't just Florida that's having problems.
Mm-hmm.
We all need to take responsibility for asking how we can check our ballot to make sure we've actually recorded what we think we've recorded. It isn't that difficult to do, but we're, you know, you're dealing with voters, some of whom can't see very well, or have physical, sometimes have physical disabilities. So there's all kinds of health problems, but there are some things we can try to do to make the system better here, just without things need to be changed, but there are some small things we can do. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks very much for that perspective.
Yeah, one quick comment. I mean, my fear is that we don't even understand the scope of how bad the problem is. You know, for instance, there are states like Alaska where there are more registered voters than there are people who live in the state. They have problems purging the rolls, you know, and it has to do with our system of how we make people register to vote. You know, other countries, you don't have to register to vote. You vote because you breathe. Anyone who's of age gets to vote, and you just use your driver's license, whatever, to go in and say who you are, and you vote. But because of how we make people register to vote here, and we have to keep track of who's registered to vote, and all these other technicalities that and barriers we erect to voters about about what they have to do to vote, it creates more problems than it solves. You know, for instance, I appreciate what the previous call said about it being an election judge is hard to get people. It certainly is. But if we didn't have elections on the first Tuesday in the middle of a work day, if we had them on a weekend or made it a holiday, you would suddenly have all sorts of people who are available to help out with our elections. If you had them on a weekend or a holiday, students, for instance, could help out, because it is true that a lot of the people who help out now tend to be older, and, you know, bless their hearts for donating their time. But, you know, some of the older people, they're not exactly spry, and you know, they easily get confused. And if they're confused, then voters get confused. And so if we did other things, like changing the day of our elections, we suddenly would solve the problem of getting people to help out with the polls. So, you know, again, we have to look at this problem, and we have to start from the beginning. I'm suggesting we have to pretty much tear it all up and start all over again from scratch, because what we're doing right now is backfiring and failing in numerous ways that we aren't even keeping track of right now.
We're talking this morning with Stephen Hill. He's the author of the book Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, recently published by Rutledge Press. We have a couple of callers waiting, and we'll get right to them. Stephen, I do want to just sort of interject here and make sure we get to some of the most important points you make in the book, and give you a chance to talk about instant runoff voting in particular and describe what that is.
Well, instant runoff voting, as I was talking about earlier, if we'd used it in Florida, voters would have gotten to rank their candidates instead of just picking one candidate. And so voters could have put their first choice first, and then they get to indicate their second choice, which is a runoff choice, and their third choice. And you do that by ranking your ballot. You know, different ballots have different designs, but basically whatever way you do it in your county, there would be a way to where you would get to indicate your first, second, and third choices. And I mean, interestingly enough, in Florida, all those voters that you know, erroneously picked Pat Buchanan with the infamous butterfly ballot, they would have been able to indicate their second choice somehow too. And somewhere in there, they may have gotten it right, by putting Al Gore, which is who they were really trying to vote for. And so, with the instant runoff voting, if your first choice doesn't win, your vote goes to your second choice, to your runoff choice. And by doing it that way, you make sure that the eventual winner has a majority of the vote, and you do it in one election so you don't encounter the problems of costs and having to set up the polls for a second election that you have with a traditional two-round runoff. So the instant runoff voting proposal is gaining a lot of interest in this country. For instance, all throughout the South, you have runoffs being used both for the primary elections if no one gets a majority, and then in the general elections. Sometimes it takes four elections in many states in the South to elect a single office, and it burns voters out. You can see each election that the voter turnout drops until finally by the end hardly anyone is voting at all. And so I think instant runoff voting is becoming attractive, and now that we have the voting equipment technology to be able to quickly and efficiently handle these kind of ranked ballots, we're seeing a lot of interest. This is the system that we passed in San Francisco this past March, and starting in November 2003, San Francisco will use instant runoff voting to elect all local offices. It's also being used by the Utah Republican Party to nominate their congressional candidates in primaries, because oftentimes in primaries we see a multi-candidate field. And as a result, someone will win the primary with, say, 20% of the vote or 25% of the vote. And so it's not even clear that candidate is really supported by their party. They just had a narrow base of support that allowed them to beat everyone else. And so using instant runoff in party primaries is a great way to make sure that the candidates, the nominated candidates, have the support of the majority of their party behind them. And there's other places that are using instant runoff voting as well. System that I talk about in my book is called proportional representation, which is what you use to elect legislatures. And the way that works is if a political party gets 60% of the popular vote, they get 60% of the seats, of the legislative seats. If a party gets 30% of the popular vote, they get 30% of the seats. And if they get 10% of the popular vote, they get 10% of the seats. It's a proportional representation. You get the allocation of seats that match your percentage of the popular vote. And by doing it that way, you give voters more choice. You open up the political process to other candidates and to other parties being able to run and actually win seats in the legislature. And that has salutary effects on not only on representation, but now on participation, because suddenly voters have more choice. We're not stuck with these lockdown safe seats where incumbents have redrawn the district lines to give them safe seats and nobody has any choice. And it also has salutary effects on how campaigns are conducted, because once you introduce multi-candidate fields, suddenly the polls and the focus groups and the way the two parties run their elections today vis-a-vis each other is not so such a cozy game. And you introduce a third perspective in there, like when Jesse Ventura ran in Montana. Suddenly a whole new perspective was able to be introduced. New ideas came into the debates, and the candidates had to take positions on them. So that's what happens when you have proportional representation. It also has a positive impact on the policy that gets passed and our sense of national cohesion. So those are the other things that I talk about in my book.
Yeah. So in the case of proportional representation, I mean, there are many European nations that actually use that. For example, I believe Germany, where the Green Party has become a very powerful force.
Exactly. In fact, most established democracies in the world use proportional representation. The trend in the world is away from our winner-take-all system, because the winner-take-all system is an 18th century system. We essentially invented it in the 18th century, and then about 100 years after that, people started looking at the problems with the winner-take-all system, and they invented what's known as proportional representation. In fact, it was invented in the United States by an MIT a professor who, you know, was looking at the problems and said, hey, there was a better way to do it. And in fact, in Illinois, as one of your earlier callers alluded to, you have a history of using what's called a semi-proportional system, cumulative voting, where you had three-seat districts, and every voter in these three-seat districts had three votes, and you could put all three votes on one candidate if you wanted to. And it allowed you to express a strong preference for a particular candidate. And interestingly enough, in Illinois, when you use that system, every three-seat district elected a Democrat or Republicans. It wasn't just one party dominating the district. And you saw independents and mavericks being able to win against the party bosses. Chicago, for instance, which is now pretty much exclusively elects Democrats, elected a few Republicans. Downstate, DuPage County, which now elects Republicans, elected some Democrats. And what that meant is that in the party caucuses, you had, say, a Republican in the Republican caucus saying, hey, we've got to do something for education in the city. We've got to do something for transportation, other issues that we care about in our cities. And same with the Democrats in the downstate areas. Whereas now, with your single-seat district system, things have completely polarized along these regional lines. And so the Republicans don't have any incentive to do something for the cities because they don't win votes there. And the Democrats don't have incentive to do things for the places that they don't win votes in. And so people like Abner Mikva and Jim Edgar and others have called for a return to cumulative voting because they say it unified your state more and didn't create such balkanized and polarized politics where the politics are now dominated by the four tops, the four top legislative leaders. You had more input percolating up from the grassroots and from voters, and so, you know, a lot of both the Chicago dailies have opined in favor of returning to cumulative voting.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go next to another listener in Urbana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, it's good to hear someone talking about the technology of voting and how important it is. And I think you've basically are zeroing in on a really important problem. But a couple things kind of bother me. One is that you seem to think that computer voting would be all that great. I want to quote a few lines from Victoria Collier about that topic last year. She says, and I agree with her, the punch card is being replaced by the computer voting machine, the most unverifiable, riggable voting system ever created. There's no longer a paper trail, no way to go back and recount if fraud is suspected. All the workings of the machine are hidden from the public eye and the eyes of election officials. And she goes on to say that these corporations won't allow access to the source code, and she points out how election officials are willingly abdicating their responsibility to oversee the safety of the vote count. So I would caution about putting much faith in being able to see a photograph of who you're voting for, because between that image of who you're voting for and the count, there could be a million flip-flops. But I have a question, and this question is, you've talked a little bit about proportional representation, which I think is really the only hope I would ever have of having somebody represent my point of view, because which makes me ask, why is it that it seems that your institute seems to favor instant runoff in some areas and proportional representation in others? And instant runoff, it seems, like, for example, in a three-way race, like happens in Florida at the presidential level with Bush, Gore, and Nader, you know, it would just seem to funnel Nader's votes to Gore, and which, you know, makes some people happy, but it's still just the two parties, and there's no, and you yourself have said that would not encourage third party wins. So why is it that in some places you favor proportional representation, and in some places you favor instant runoff? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Great. Yeah, raised some really good points. So I'll try to address them here as briefly as I can. In general, my Center for Voting and Democracy, we think that proportional representation is the way to elect legislatures. And instant runoff voting is the way to elect single executives like mayor, governor, or president. In order to elect something by proportional representation, you have to use what's known as multi-seat districts, more than one seat per district, whereas the winner-take-all system, for the most part, relies on single-seat districts. And by multi-seat district, what I mean is, let's say you have a district with 10 seats in it. With proportional representation, every seat is weighted equally to the exact same number of votes. And so if you win in a 10-seat district, 30% of the popular vote, you get 3 out of 10 of those seats. If you win 60% of the popular vote, you get 6 out of the 10 of those seats. If you win 10% of the popular vote, you get 1 out of 10 of those seats. So in order to do proportional representation, you have to use multi-seat districts. It doesn't have to be a 10-seat district. It can be a 3-seat district, 4-seat district, whatever size makes sense. The key is the more seats you elect at one time in that multi-seat district, the lower the threshold. When I was saying you need 10% of the vote to win one seat in a 10-seat district, in a 5-seat district, you would need 20% of the vote to win one seat. You just take the number of seats that are being elected at once and you divide it into 100%, and that gives you the approximate number of votes, 20% in a 5-seat district.
But you can't have more than one president.
Exactly. But when it comes to single executive races, you can't have more than one governor, more than one president, more than one mayor. So for those, we believe that the best way to do it is instant runoff voting, because you get the candidate that's preferred by the most voters in those races, and you do it all in a one election, because, you know, if you use a two-round runoff, you run into problems there where it costs a lot of money for that second election. Candidates have to raise money for a second election, which undermines campaign finance reform. And, you know, voters get tired of having to trudge out to the polls all the time. You see voter turnout declines in those second runoff elections. So we think the instant runoff voting is a better way to do that. And so that's why we talk about both of the systems. Something else to realize in terms of proportional representation, you actually can combine proportional representation with our single-seat district system. And some people think this might be the best transitional system for the United States, because Germany, for instance, uses that combination. It's called a mixed-member system, where voters, when they go into the voters' booth, they have two votes. One is for their district representative, just like what we have now, and the other is for what's called a list. You vote for the party and their list of candidates that have been determined ahead of time and during a party caucus. And you get the legislature has a mix of both types of legislators in there, some that represent a geographic area, some that represent a political party. And as a result, the winner-take-all system basically gives you representation based on where you live. Proportional representation gives you representation based on what you think. And so, you know, there are merits to both of them. The problem with doing it exclusively by where you live, which is how we do it in the U.S., is that many, many people end up being shut out of the political process because some voters gain a representative, they win, and everyone else loses. And so that's where the winner-take-all aspect comes in. So using some combination I think could be a nice transition for the United States.
I'm sorry to cut in, but we have literally about a minute left, and another caller I must apologize to. I took too long, and hopefully we'll continue this topic at some later point. Stephen, I want to ask just real quickly if you could tell us, how would these changes be brought about? What are the mechanisms to put these things in place?
The mechanisms are, first of all, education, because we've got to educate people about how these different options are out there, that we aren't stuck with just our winner-take-all ways that we've used for the last two centuries. There are options. And so first thing we need to do is educate ourselves. We can go to the website of my organization, the Center for Voting and Democracy, which is www.fairvote.org, and there's lots of information there that you could use to educate yourself, and then, you know, start handing it out to your friends, your family members, your coworkers. Educate them. Once we do that, then starting to lobby and starting to use voter initiatives. The U.S. Constitution and most state constitutions are silent on these issues, and so just by passing applicable state laws at local, state, and even federal levels, we could implement proportional representation for our city councils, for our state legislatures, and for the U.S. House. For the Senate, we would have to do some other things that involve changing the Constitution. But and then also for instant runoff voting, same thing. You know, here in San Francisco, we passed instant runoff voting by changing our city charter. We put it on the ballot, and then voters decided, they voted 55% in favor of changing to instant runoff voting. So we can do that in all the myriad ways that we have pushed other reforms like campaign finance reform and others. And then also getting legislators involved, because we have found legislators who are very open to these ideas. They realize that, you know, we have problems in this country that aren't going to be solved under the current system. And so they're open to these ideas. So I urge people to start contacting their legislators and talk about it. We need to basically start a national conversation, and we do that by starting locally and regionally and in your state.
Okay. We're going to have to stop there. Stephen Hill has been our guest. The book, Fixing Elections. Elections, A Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, published by the Rutledge Press. Stephen, thank you so much for talking with us.
One quick thing, if people want to check out an excerpt, you can go to the website for the book, which is www.fixingelections.com.
Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Pleasure.